Tuesday, your vote is going to save our country. Most important election we've ever had.
We choose hope over fear. We choose unity over division, science over fiction, and yes, truth over lies.
It's Election Day in the United States. This is the Wednesday, November 4th edition of VOA Asia, a special U.S. presidential election program as voting concludes. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Political polls got it wrong 4 years ago. Have they changed? Tight voting in several states, campaign promises, other races, and educating voters amid COVID. It's all on this special edition of VOA Asia. U.S. voters have cast their ballots for either President Donald Trump or former Vice President Joe Biden. As the votes are counted and states, which carry a number of electoral votes depending on their population size, are won or lost, each candidate is hoping to reach the winning number of at least 270 Electoral College votes. Ahead of the election, political polls have been trying to predict how the candidates fared among people eligible to vote. But in 2016, the polls were largely incorrect. Hillary Clinton was said to have had a large advantage over Donald Trump. This year, Joe Biden has a sizable lead. Should we believe it? VOA's Adriana Zhang spoke with John C. Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, to find out what has changed from 4 years ago.
Polling is an industry that, very broadly speaking, tries to survey a representative sample of the population and understand the opinions of those people to give some broader sense of how the country is feeling about an election or about other matters. In 2016, we had some polling error. We always have a little bit of error. The national polls were not so far off. They were slightly more favorable to Hillary Clinton than the result. What we really saw was some polling failure in the states, especially in key states. One, we didn't poll there enough, and two, the results showed a bigger Hillary Clinton win in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And those made the difference. Today, Joe Biden has a larger lead that in the polls than Hillary Clinton had over Donald Trump in 2016. Of course, there can be polling error, but it could be in either direction. And you know, generally, polls have a good track record, but they can be off, and perhaps they could be missing a trend that we're not seeing.
What are the pollsters doing to prevent the same mistake, or can they prevent the mistake due to shy Trump supporters?
One thing we're doing, of course, is polling more in those states that we didn't poll enough in last time. And many pollsters are more attuned to polling for educational differences in the white vote, the non-college white vote versus the college white vote. In 2016, we did not appreciate how big that difference would be between Donald Trump voters and Hillary Clinton voters. It had been growing a bit between the parties, but Donald Trump really expanded that divide. And because we didn't poll as much with that divide in mind, we may have missed some trends that were helping Donald Trump. Many pollsters, not all, but many pollsters are looking for that sort of divide this time. What are the difference between white working class voters and white college educated voters? Of course, we could be missing another trend by not looking for something else. So that is not necessarily perfect, but pollsters are trying to account for some of the things that caused the 2016 polls to be off.
What would happen if most of the polls get it wrong this year again?
Well, I do think if you mean the you know, what today is a much bigger margin that Joe Biden has over Donald Trump, a very big polling error would be surprising. As I said, the polling error at the national level was not very large in 2016. You know, we also had polling error in the other direction in 2012 with Mitt Romney seeming to do better than he really did. But if a polling error is very, very large, I think there will be some serious reconsideration of what we are doing. But again, I do think that while there are challenges, the polling market and how you reach voters and how you get people to respond to polls, pollsters are trying to deal with those difficulties.
How do you think the pollsters can improve their work?
Pollsters are always looking after an election or after they poll to what went wrong. And I think that they should continue to do. The world is changing. People are using different modes of communicating. And sometimes the political world is changing and we're not spotting certain trends. So I think the most important thing for pollsters is to really continue to self-evaluate themselves and see what has changed that doesn't work anymore, and look forward to, you know, a new methods for the next election. And I think broadly pollsters do that.
John C. Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, speaking with VOA's Adriana John. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State condemns arrests of Hong Kong pro-democracy activists. Australia joins India, U.S., and Japan in Indian Ocean War Games. The United States says ball is in China's court to reverse U.S.-China decoupling. Islamic State claims Kabul University attack that killed 22. Trump's Afghan peace envoy visited Pakistan on eve of U.S. election. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit us at Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Concession speeches from defeated political rivals have traditionally played a key role in legitimizing American democracy. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports, there may not be one today or soon after if the U.S. presidential election results are close.
For 36 days after the 2000 presidential election, in which the margin of victory came down to a few hundred votes in the key state of Florida, Democratic candidate Al Gore and Republican rival George W. Bush engaged in legal disputes over the ballot count. But after a conservative majority on the Supreme Court sided with the Bush campaign, Gore conceded the race and pledged to support the incoming President Bush.
And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
On election night in 2016, Democrat Hillary Clinton struck a similar unifying tone in congratulating Republican Donald Trump on his upset presidential victory.
We must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
Both Gore and Clinton lost in the official Electoral College system designed to give rural states added representation despite winning the national popular vote. This year, Clinton advised Democratic candidate Joe Biden not to concede under any circumstances, as she expects the Trump campaign to contest mail-in or absentee ballots that surveys indicate are being cast by significantly more Democrats than Republicans. At the first presidential debate, Biden said he would accept the election outcome, but only after all the votes are counted. That could take some time.
And in terms of whether or not when the votes are counted and they're all counted, that will be accepted. If I win, that will be accepted. If I lose, that'll be accepted.
Trump, who is trailing in presidential opinion polls, has repeatedly said he may not accept the election results if Biden is deemed the winner, citing unverified claims of massive mail-in voting fraud and abuse.
They found some with the name Trump, just happened to have the name Trump just the other day in a waste paper basket. They're being sent all over the place. They sent two in a Democrat area. They sent out 1,000 ballots. Everybody got two ballots. This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen.
Analysts worry that a refusal by the losing candidate to accept the results and call upon supporters to do the same could weaken public faith in democracy.
A prolonged dispute could be very damaging for confidence in our democracy and the legitimacy of the next president.
With partisan tensions so high this year, both sides also fear a bitterly contested election could spark political violence from right-wing extremists and radical leftists. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, the Australian Navy joined Indian, Japanese, and American warships for annual Malabar exercises in the Indian Ocean, marking the growing strategic convergence of the four countries amid rising concerns about Chinese assertiveness in Asia. Australia returns to the exercises after 13 years. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us for our special presidential election coverage on VOA Asia. U.S. states are usually referred to by color, red for Republican and blue for Democrat. When states become too close to predict, they're called purple, as in mixing those colors of red and blue. Texas has traditionally been red, but this year the second largest U.S. state appears to be changing. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains why Texas is one of those states turning purple.
In rural Carn City, Texas, ranchers and farmers are firing up their tractors to caravan for Donald Trump. Tracy Gendrish is riding his tried-and-true tractor.
It's an old dog, but it's probably a 78 or 80 model, 40 years old, you know. But it's still running like a baby doll.
Gendrich's great-grandfather moved to the U.S. from Poland. His family has been farming ever since, and he's always been self-employed, just like Trump.
He's an independent businessman. He's not a politician, you know. And I love what he's doing.
More than 380 kilometers south at the Texas-Mexico border city of Brownsville, Democrats are revved up for Joe Biden. David Betancourt, whose grandparents are Hispanic, says he disapproves of how Trump has handled his presidency.
Donald Trump is just a very self-centered human being. It's obvious, and I think we're all kind of tired of that.
The political parties on both sides of the presidential race are highly mobilized in a state that had been a model of Republican conservatism. 1976 was the last time Texas supported a Democratic presidential candidate. But the dynamics are changing in the second largest state in the country, says University of Texas government professor Jim Henson.
This year in 2020, you can actually see a path for Biden to narrowly win the state.
Texas is deeply divided between the red Republican rural regions and the blue Democratic urban areas. But the bridge between the two areas, the suburb, is changing Texas politics. The communities outside the urban centers used to be Republican strongholds, but they are turning purple due to nearly a decade of rapid population growth, economic development, and migration.
As people from California, from other parts of Texas, from the cities that were close to those suburbs that moved out looking for better schools and cheaper housing, as all those people moved around, a lot of them settled in those districts, and they changed those districts.
Minorities such as African Americans, Latinos, East and South Asians make up the faces of many suburbs. The different ethnicities, as well as whites, lead to a greater mix of political beliefs. In addition to the voters in the suburbs, the Latino vote is another factor. While the majority of Latinos consider themselves Democrats, in some cases, Republican candidates in Texas have earned more than 40% of the Latino vote. Voter turnout among Latinos, especially in the border towns, has been a challenge for the Democrats. But Republicans at this parade, including one of its organizers, Sean O'Brien, do not think Texas will become a Democratic state.
I don't think it's ever going to turn blue, but yeah, purple maybe.
A polling average shows Trump and Biden essentially tied in Texas. Henson says the Republicans and Democrats are doing everything they can to mobilize people to vote in hopes of making a difference in the Lone Star State. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. Islamic State claimed responsibility for Monday's attack on Kabul University that killed at least 22 people and injured a dozen more. Afghan security forces said the attack ended after an hours-long gunfight. You'll find these stories and more throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with our special edition of VOA Asia. Campaign promises are always made as candidates seek votes. 4 years ago, when he campaigned, Donald Trump promised to build a southern border wall to help control illegal immigration. Trump spoke about it again during the last presidential debate of 2020. VOA's Elizabeth Lee joins us again for this update on the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The Rio Grande River, the natural border between the U.S. and Mexico, has become an unofficial gateway for some and a battleground for others.
We continue to see narcotics attempting to come into the country, as well as the smuggling of weapons and ammunition out of the country. These are criminal organizations that claim ownership of part of the territory that they smuggle people or contraband through.
In Laredo, Texas, manpower is a challenge in the more than 270 kilometers that make up this sector.
We rely on kind of the balance of personnel, technology, and infrastructure.
Prior to the Trump administration, there had been some infrastructure or physical barrier in place along some of the more than 3,000 kilometers that make up the southern border.
Build a great.
During his bid for president, then-candidate Donald Trump promised to also build a wall at the border.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border.
On Super Tuesday 2016, when voters picked their party candidate, Trump talked about how much wall he would build.
We need 1,000 miles, and we have all of the materials. We can do that so beautifully.
As of the last presidential debate in 2020, Trump gave this update.
We're over 400 miles of brand new wall.
Customs and Border Protection Acting Commissioner Mark Morgan discussed the border wall the day after the debate.
By the end of this calendar year, I'm confident we're going to be at the 450-mile mark. And then currently right now, the president has given us funding for a combined total of 730 miles.
Morgan says the wall funding, some $15 billion, comes from multiple sources, including Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. $1.3 billion was authorized by Congress. The president's authority to use much of the money is currently being challenged in court and is awaiting a Supreme Court decision.
He has no authority to spend money that Congress hasn't given him.
Also in litigation, government lawsuits against landowners who refuse to give up their land for the wall. They and other opponents say a border wall is wasteful and ineffective. For now, construction continues. Some of the new wall along the southern border replaces existing barriers, while the rest is being built where no barrier has existed, such as in Laredo. In addition to the new wall system, which comes with lighting, technology, and access roads, other technologies are also used. An example is the surveillance equipment that uses artificial intelligence. Democrats say they support more surveillance technology as an alternative to building more walls. Just how many miles of new wall will be constructed may depend on the Supreme Court's decision and the outcome of the presidential election. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take, wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
In addition to the presidential candidates, elections also decide important contests for the U.S. Congress and local offices. Voters also consider specific issues, some which have national or even international implications. In California, voters are deciding on an initiative that would keep people who work in the so-called gig economy as independent contractors, not employees. Michelle Quinn reports.
When her employer cut her hours, Maria Hernandez, a healthcare worker, turned to driving for Lyft, the ride-hailing firm, to make up lost income. She likes it, meeting people and picking up work when she can.
I think the flexibility is a wonderful thing because it has helped me a lot with my other job.
The so-called gig economy, which uses apps to connect people like Hernandez to jobs, is under threat in the Golden State. Voters are deciding on Proposition 22, a ballot initiative sponsored by companies like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and others. They have spent nearly $200 million on it, the most ever for a state initiative. A lot is at stake. If Prop 22 passes, it would keep drivers like Hernandez as independent contractors. Opponents include major labor unions who argue that there is already a state law, which the firms are challenging, requiring them to treat workers as employees with protections such as sick leave, overtime, and other benefits. Among Uber and Lyft drivers, there's a divide over the initiative, says Chris Gerassi, a contributor to the Rideshare Guy, a media outlet for gig economy workers, and an Uber driver in Buffalo, New York. Full-time drivers tend to support the initiative, he said, while the majority of drivers, part-timers like himself, value flexibility. At a recent protest against the initiative in San Francisco, some drivers said they had had enough.
I'm here because I'm a rideshare driver. I've given close to 20,000 rides, and so I'm very familiar with the exploitation that these companies put us through. We have low pay. We have no access to benefits. It's just unjust.
Ken Jacobs, the chair of the Labor Center at the University of California, Berkeley, argues that if the ballot initiative passes, it will send a signal to other governments seeking to get the companies to comply with labor laws.
If it passes, then they send a very strong signal to other states in the U.S. who are looking to enforce their own wage and hour laws, and other countries, that not only will they not abide by the laws, but that they've amassed enough money that they have the power to change laws that do not allow them to do whatever they want to do.
One thing is certain, the stakes are high for workers and customers in this battle over the future of work. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
As Americans participate in the 2020 election during a pandemic, the Atlanta, Georgia-based Carter Center, founded by former President Jimmy Carter, is working to educate U.S. voters. We hear more from VOA's Kane Faribault.
Launched in 1986 by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalynn, the Carter Center has long promoted peace and democracy around the globe. As part of that mission, the Carter Center became a leading election monitoring organization, observing more than 110 contests in Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
We've always worked for peace around the world, but we've kind of ignored the United States.
Among the reasons, judging the fairness of elections is a monumental task in a nation like the United States, where all 50 states have differing laws and rules for voting and counting ballots.
The Constitution basically says that each state is independent. And that's one of the reasons why we have such a diverse way of conducting elections.
But after U.S. intelligence agencies documented foreign interference in the 2016 U.S. election and predicted a repeat in 2020, the Carter Center concluded their international experience might help at home by focusing on voter education.
You know, when people understand how the election process works, it helps them to set their own expectations about the process. And with that, you can sort of build confidence in the overall administration of the election process. So,
Amory Davis Roberts is an associate director in the Carter Center's democracy program.
You're going to want to buckle up for this one.
Which has been working to educate Americans about casting absentee and mail-in ballots, a record number of which were requested this year because of the coronavirus pandemic.
This is an unusual election for the United States. You know, we haven't, in my lived experience, been through an election like this. You know, I think we're all sort of learning as we go.
The Carter Center recently joined the Georgia Bipartisan Task Force on Safe, Secure, and Accessible Elections and is offering expertise and guidance to officials in the state, where voters are not only casting ballots for president, but also two U.S. senators.
Your vote, your voice is important.
The center is also offering training for journalists on international election standards and transparency, and hosting virtual conferences about voting. But Davis Roberts emphasizes the Carter Center is not officially observing the 2020 U.S. election.
We're not going to be making an overall statement on the degree to which the entire electoral process met international standards as we might in other countries where we are able to deploy a sort of a large-scale systematic observation mission.
Even so, the Carter Center aims to promote transparency and patience.
We want all of the votes to be counted. We want to know that every voice is heard, and so we have to be patient and we have to sort of allow that process to unfold.
Former President Carter's hopes for America extend far beyond boosting voter participation and confidence in elections.
Not only in peace, but also human rights and environmental equality and the treatment of everybody as equals, no matter what their religion might be or no matter what party they might be.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
VOA has all of the latest election results as they continue to come in. Get the latest at VOA Asia Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and our website, voanews.com. Our program has been brought to you by Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.